Log Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, this is Debbie Brock with Homeopathy World Community. It appears that our sound went out for a little bit, but hopefully those people who are listening were able to hear something. And I'm checking whether any of the callers are able to hear me this evening.
Yes, Debbie. Hi, it's Greg.
Wonderful, because I totally lost sound at the beginning of the show, and I'm glad that, Greg, that's you, is it not?
Yeah. That's me.
Okay, and Alan, are you there?
I am here.
Wonderful. All right, so now we're going to just get on with the regular introduction. I have a special guest. My little granddaughter is sitting on my knee with me, so we're going to see how that goes as well. But so what we have here is our regular show, which is on Thursday. We're pre-recording on Tuesday evening. And I will do my best to rebroadcast, if it's possible, our regularly scheduled show of Homeopathy World Community Vaccinations and Your Rights in the United States with co-host Alan Phillips, attorney at law, and Greg Glazer, attorney at law. And today is August 2nd, 2011. Thank you to everyone who does tune in to listen and learn about constitutional law, their rights, freedoms, and how we maintain them or bring them into being if we feel like we're losing them. And I also want to say that I appreciate when you comment on the live chat or share these shows with your friends via Twitter or Facebook or become a friend or follower on the network. And if you're new to BTR, Blog Talk Radio, you'll find the chat right below the announcement page on the internet. Okay, and we're going to be talking today about the right to be peacefully natural, which is something we've talked about extensively in the past, versus the tyranny of absolute power. And, you know, we can take a look at our world today and probably, I don't know if we'll ever see examples of truly being peacefully natural, but maybe Greg can clue us in on that. I always think of when he speaks about that as being a utopian type of world. And if we have time, we'll talk about parental rights versus the government-mandated needles in children. And we do have live examples of situations where this might come into play. And then finally, health freedom and nanotechnology and vaccines, which is part of our futuristic type of world. And I'm going to turn the show over to Greg, and he's going to get us started with the first theme or topic of today.
Yes, I would be happy to, and thank you for the introduction, Debbie. Yeah, so the right to be peacefully natural is the fundamental right of fundamental. It's this premise that government receives its power from the people, and it is therefore limited in its ability. And as long as we recognize that there is such a thing as a right, then there is certainly the right to be peacefully natural, because a peacefully natural person can do nothing to avoid the consequence of a law. So, for example, if I say that it's a crime to have blue eyes, well, if I have blue eyes, there's nothing I can do to avoid the consequence of the law. And so legal scholars have made it very clear that that is a fundamental requirement for a just and constitutional or moral law. And this has been stated as a requirement not just in American law, but in other countries' law and in international law as well. It's just this fundamental moral premise that we all accept. And this particular principle really doesn't get much airtime or doesn't get much much interest, because it's so infrequent that we'll find a practical application where we need to apply the rule. But vaccines is that application, because a vaccine law is saying that this person is not good enough. It doesn't matter if they're peaceful. Doesn't matter if they're natural. They're not good enough. We got to put something in them. We have to force it in them. And that's the danger of a vaccine law. It makes being peacefully natural a crime. And so the public health authorities of the military-industrial complex, for example, at Georgetown, Lawrence Gostin, who wrote the Model State Health Emergency Act, would be an example, has tried to get around this. So, they all pull their minds together and think, okay, well, how can we toe the balance and still respect someone's right to refuse a vaccine in the event of an emergency, but also implement this program of lockdown and control on the people? And they've come up with this idea of the quarantine and isolation. And what that means is that you could be peaceful and natural, but you're going to have to do it in prison. You're going to have to do it in our prison. And under the and please stop me at any time if you guys have any questions, but under this model act, and now it's just a model act, and it hasn't been enacted under American law, so it's ambiguous to what extent the quarantine powers of the states, the traditional quarantine powers apply. And we've talked about that in other shows. It's basically sort of a hodgepodge of different rules patched together that give the state the power to isolate and implement quarantine measures. So, but under this Model Act, which is quite likely to be implemented after a sufficient disaster, it says that the powers of the state to vaccinate apply to anyone who consents, but for anyone who objects on the grounds of a moral or religious basis or philosophical basis can be subject to quarantine and isolation. And those two words are legal words. Quarantine is sort of the first step, and isolation is the second, more drastic step. Quarantine is when you're suspected of having a contagious disease, so you are quarantined in a particular area, can be your home. Isolate is where you have been tested and found to have this disease, and therefore you are being you're being actively isolated from the population. And so active minds will know where I'm going with this, because you can sort of see the writing on the wall. So now we were talking about being peacefully natural. So here you have this individual. Let's say let's make it a family. Let's say it's a family.
Okay. I was going to ask. This is a different scenario than if there's a outbreak of a disease and people are in hospitals being quarantined. It's different because, or is it not different?
Oh, right. Well, it's always going to depend on the locale. So the law makes it a person-by-person inquiry. So you could have a situation where the person has been isolated in a hospital, or you could have a situation where they've been isolated in a prison facility, like a camp. Or you could have a situation where they've been quarantined voluntarily at their home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it would be on a person-by-person basis. Let's take a hypothetical to illustrate my point of the danger of a breach of this rule of the right to be peacefully natural. Because as adults, we have the right to exercise our right to exemption. And Alan Phillips has done amazing work in this area in specifying what the exemption process is, and I highly recommend his book. And so the exemption that is asserted on behalf of the individual is done generally through a form. You specify that you have a religious exemption. Now, imagine the hypothetical where you have a family of three, and all three of them have decided, and the third one is a young child. Let's say that he is 4 years old. And so the four-year-old takes the exemption of his parents. The law will sometimes automatically deem you to accept the religious or philosophical exemption of your parents. And so, but now imagine that you have a government coming in and implementing this quarantine and isolation. So once the parents are deemed to have been tested for a disease, and let's say they end up contracting it, then isolation provisions kick in, making that child a ward of the state. Now, that child now gets the decision. His decisions are no longer made by his parents because his parents are now in isolation. And so he becomes a ward of the state, and the state makes the decisions on behalf of the child. And we know what the state's going to decide. It's the one implementing the vaccine programs, and therefore it will force the needle into the child. That is the danger of this particular rule. And so I read the Model State Emergency Health Act written by Lawrence Gostin, and it doesn't address this particular issue. It leaves it it's very ambiguous. And so if you had an incredibly benevolent society filled with people who implement natural remedies and are very understanding, this might not present a big issue in the event of an emergency. People would be cool. But in the present world order of industrialized solutions, where people are, imagine barbed wire concentration camps and things of that nature, medicine, gas masks, all that stuff, you have a much higher risk and a high likelihood that this scenario that I just described would play out for conscientious objectors. And so the goal, you might say, if you are anticipating, what's happening, what's going to happen in the future, what's on the horizon, if you do want to protect your right to be peacefully natural and your child's right to be peacefully natural, it may make sense to put yourself in a situation where you can, realistically quarantine yourself so that in the event that somebody does, proverbially knock down your gate and come and test you, that you will be fortunate enough to be in a place where you can say, I am quarantined. Don't take me away. Don't put me into isolation. Don't take my child away. And that you will be able to exercise your right to exemption. Because the states do recognize these exemptions. But again, it's an adult who states what the exemption is, and there's a particular danger that when the children are taken away, that the state would override the parents' exemption once they take the child away.
Let me chime in.
Yes, I'm sorry, Alan. Go ahead.
Let me chime in if I may for a moment here, because there's an interesting parallel in state case law with regard to routine immunizations, and I wonder if you think this might have a bearing on this particular issue. There was a case here in North Carolina, the North Carolina Court of Appeals, unusual set of circumstances. It had to do with parents losing the custody of their children to the state because of a combination of problematic issues, but they had not lost their parental rights. So the state had custody of the children, and the question then that was before the appellate court here in North Carolina was, could the parents still exercise a religious exemption to immunizations for their children? And the short answer was that the court said no. And I was actually surprised that the case even went up on appeal, because as much as I would like for the parents to have still been able in that situation to exercise the exemption for their children, I think the wording of our religious exemption statute here in North Carolina, it was such that to me it seemed that the right is exercisable by the parent or the person in loco parentis, Latin phrase, which really means somebody in the place of the parent. And I would assume that the state in that circumstances situation would be in loco parentis. And so that appears to have been the way the case came out. But there was a case in, and I believe it was Arizona, that was similar set of circumstances where there was a legitimate question, and it went up on appeal in the appellate courts, state appellate courts there as well. And I don't remember the specific fact scenario, but the question was a similar one before the appellate court there as to whether or not the mother in that particular situation could still exercise religious exemption right for the children. And there, the parent was still allowed and still able to. And so it was sort of interesting to me. Of course, as you know, and our listeners who pay attention to this show on a even semi-regular basis may have heard before that we have different rights in different jurisdictions because of the way courts in different jurisdictions rule. There can be different rights in different states. We can even have different rights in different parts of the country under our one federal constitution and to the extent that courts in different parts of the country rule differently on the same or similar issues. And so it is sort of curious. But those two cases were in concerning routine immunizations. When we're dealing with emergency immunizations, we are talking hypothetically about a different scenario. Because let me know if you feel differently, Greg, but I often at least generalize by saying that there probably are no rights that are absolute, and most, if not all, rights are bounded by opposing rights. And in the world of immunizations and our individual right to say no to immunization, there's this opposing right or even obligation on the part of the state to protect the citizens. And within the mainstream view of vaccines, we can allow individuals, at least in small numbers, small percentages, to refuse vaccines on whatever grounds are available in any given state. Of course, have medical exemptions.
There is an absolute right to be peacefully natural because of that danger of absolute power. So, I mean, as long as we're even using the word right, you know, and as long as there is such a thing as a right, then there must be this right to be peacefully natural. Otherwise, you'd have a form of absolute power, in which case there is no such thing as a right. There is only a balance. And that is...
But is your prior notion about being allowed to be peacefully right and natural in confinement through quarantine or isolation, is that the... Does that go into a gray area, or do you consider that to still be part of the broader... more ultimate right of the right to be peacefully natural? Because I think, and this goes to a broader question that we sort of, I think, made an assumption about but didn't really address directly. Do you think that there are, at least hypothetically, situations where people should be quarantined or isolated? You know, is infectious disease potentially a genuine problem where we as a society need to take measures with regard to certain individuals to balance the right of the community versus the individual?
Yeah, you know, I think I've watched enough zombie movies to know that I could be a pretty reactionary too. I think there is such a thing as a legitimate exercise of the police power, but here is the real essence of the answer, and I use that in that word in the strongest sense. This is an answer to this question. Man must take risk, and there is a risk about being peacefully natural. So even in the event that a meteor is going to strike the Earth, for certain, killing everyone, absolutely everyone on the planet, even in that situation, the government can't force any man to stop the meteor. It can try to do it itself, but it can't force someone to do it. That's the thing. It's that, you know, you take your hypothetical Clark Kent. He's there in Kansas. He's a free man, and he can stop the meteor. But you can't drug him. You can't mind probe him. You can't. You could just ask him. You can plead with him. That meteor will strike the Earth, killing everyone, and that is the risk, and that is the answer to the question. It's that we are, as a species, a we are bound to our right to be peaceably natural. Otherwise, when we give it up, become like a lower order species that doesn't have this virtue. As long as we recognize, again, that there is such a thing as a right, then we can't engage in these protections. But if we elevate the doctrine of survival above the doctrine of virtue, then we have compromised our ideal and can no longer say that we live in a society of rights. And there are some things that we cannot give. There are some things that are not ours to give. And those belong to the individual and are, you might say, the contract between the individual and his or her creator. And so it's we have to continually come back to this principle of virtue and right, and a law does not take on its authority by its mere issuance, but by its virtue. The Nazis, they were exterminating the Jews, issued all kinds of lofty orders and opinions, but those orders and opinions were not lawful. They were in violation of law, and from their very issuance. And the United States has recognized that doctrine in an old case called Norton versus Shelby, and this is from 1885. And I'll read it just one sentence. It's very, very powerful. Unconstitutional act is not a law, confers no rights, imposes no duties, affords no protection, creates no office. It is in legal contemplation, as inoperative as though it had never been passed. And so let's take that full circle. Now it's very powerful. Now let's take it full circle to Jacobson, which is the case discussing vaccines. If you go to the military-industrial complex for answers, they will point to Jacobson and say, Jacobson gives us the right to forcefully vaccinate people. But the Jacobson case does not do that. And I go into detail. I have a memo which is on the Pandemic Response Project website. And in my memo, I go into detail as to why Jacobson doesn't say that, but let me just put it out there in one sentence. And this is a quote directly from the Supreme Court of the United States in Jacobson versus Massachusetts. Yes, one sentence. There is, of course, a sphere within which the individual may assert the supremacy of his own will and rightfully dispute the authority of any human, especially any free government existing under a written constitution, to interfere with the exercise that will. And that so that quote is encapsulating the very doctrine that I am discussing. It's that if there is such a right, if there is such a will to be free and that we're going to recognize it, then it has to be this right to be peacefully natural, because it's the only thing that we can point to and say, yeah, you can't avoid it. You're born into this world as a little baby, incredibly peaceful, incredibly natural, and how can we take that away? There's no danger that is ever presented by someone who is living peacefully and natural. And even if it's quite natural for a meteor to find its course to find a way to strike the Earth, even if that were the case, we have to recognize that there is a risk that we take, and that sometimes, and this is the holistic approach, not just medicine but to law, sometimes you have to naturally accept that your time is up.
Brett, it sounds like the difference is that I think of government as existing partially to protect the people, and you're saying in this case it's not going to protect the people against an infectious disease?
I'm saying that the government has the duty to implement public health programs, but those public health programs may never infringe on the right of someone to be peacefully natural. So if you have someone who is has an infectious disease, and they are going around into the public square and coughing on people, that's
right,
not peaceful. And so that would be an instance where another individual in causal proximity to that person would have the right of self-defense to stop them or even go so far as to kill them right there on the spot. And then they could, you know, put the body in a plastic bag and, you know, and so forth, because that is the right of self-defense. That's where the government derived the police power from back in the ancient days. And that power has never expanded. The Constitution never gave the government more power than was originally derived from the people. And so that right of self-defense is the origin of the police power. And the public health programs take their origin also from the police power. Now, there's a dichotomy in jurisdiction. And actually, before I get into this point about jurisdiction, kind of a legal nuance, did you guys want to talk about that point more, or should I go on?
I'm trying to take it all in and understand that I feel like there's a very fine line, and it does have to be taken instance by instance, individual cases, because someone has to be a judge and a jury and determine whether a person is behaving peacefully, natural, and not crossing that fine line that goes into potentially hurting another person. Because if I think about contagious disease, it spreads even before anybody even knows that it's occurring. If I think about the prodromal state of disease, when a person just starts to cough and sneeze and they're in a classroom, and you know, we don't know whether it's just the regular cold or whether it is something more than that.
Yeah.
So it seems like we have to take it case by case, and that whether a person is taking action to protect themselves and anyone else from getting this disease.
Well, clearly the police power that gives states the right to quarantine and isolation in theory anyway has and would exercise that power in defense of the of other citizens and a presumed threat, you know, from the person who's either been exposed or believed to be exposed in the case of quarantine, or who has been identified as actually having the disease in the case of isolation. Would you agree with that, Greg, or is there some other more subtle point I'm missing there?
I'll even add a Supreme Court quote to it. It says, under the police, and this is from Panhandle Eastern Pipeline Company, 1935, so this is what the Supreme Court says, under the police power, there is no unrestricted authority to accomplish whatever the public may presently desire. It is the governmental power of self-protection and permits reasonable regulation of rights and property, in particular, is essential to the preservation of the community from injury. So it's limited, the police power is. And what's the other case? Lessee is the other case. And it's one of those things where, you know, the government has the power to protect the public health, but the public health has been defined. And therefore, it's going to be interpreted. It's like if I tell you that you know, we're gonna bake a cake, and then you go out and get, you know, three rotten eggs from a diseased chicken and a lump of sugar that's just been sitting out for like 10 years, you know, you're gonna have a nasty cake even though the picture and the directions look fine. And so the interpretation of the law and the ingredients that go into the law, the government structure itself, the ingredients will bear on the outcome here. And so, you know, we can cite Supreme Court cases all day long, but what's going to happen when the next public health emergency happens is going to be a very diverse experience. Might be the best way to say it. You know, we don't exactly know what's going to happen, and even the scholars who write for the military industrial complex, like Goss and like Fidler, admit this in their writings. They say that there is uncertainty as to the how these laws will be implemented in the event of an emergency. And they use that example to justify why there needs to be greater harmony and why all the states have to implement this act. But all the same, it emphasizes the point that we don't know how the government will ultimately end up implementing these things, which is why I keep going back to my point that if you see the writing on the wall, try to quarantine yourself and or try to put yourself in a position on land, natural land, where you can quarantine yourself and your family. Otherwise, there is a danger that a government official could come knocking on your door, forcefully test you, and then take you away. And the writing on the wall is this statute that I'm telling you about, this model statute. And then even if we just disregarded that statute, say, oh, well, it won't even be enacted, then we just defer to the ordinary state powers. And then, those are quite ambiguous as well. And those allow for, your general quarantine powers and quarantine, isolation, public health measures, and may even be stronger. The traditional powers may even be stronger than the current act. So it shall be interesting. But the Congressional Research Service, like Kathleen Swenneman would be an example of an attorney who writes for the Congressional Research Service, has said in no uncertain terms that mandatory vaccination is one of the powers of the government. But she says that, and then we'll quote to like some website, and it's not even a quote to a law. It's just, and there's that danger, that you're going to have attorneys and laymen who don't do the reading, who don't know what's really going on, who don't recognize your right to be peacefully natural and to absorb and to execute these exemptions. And so, I give an example of how this happened not too long ago. Was in Prince George's County, and I think it's Maryland, and the attorney general was saying on the record that the schools were requiring vaccination, and that was a good thing. But in fact, it wasn't mandatory vaccination. What they were doing is he said that it'd be a misdemeanor if you're abused. But what really was happening is that it was a sidestep, saying that if parents were being charged with misdemeanors for truancy, meaning that like if the child refused vaccination, the parents refused vaccination, then the kids would get kicked out of school. And once the kids are not in school, that triggers the possible truancy violation because they have to be in some school. So they have to be homeschooled or something else. And so it's actually the truancy violation. But it's with trickery, that they get you to that point because you think, oh, well, it's mandatory vaccination. But no, it's not. And the reason why it's not is because of what I'm saying, is that there's no law that I've found that specifically mandates vaccination. I've found, look, federal law, I've looked in state law, and I've looked...
Wait a minute. What do you mean you've never seen a law that mandates vaccination? That's done in 50 states, every territory, and federal government, all over the place.
I'm saying that I've looked and I have not found it. I'm not saying that it doesn't exist. I'm saying that I have looked and have not found it.
I'm going to have to stop you there, Greg, because I don't understand what you're saying there. Please repeat that. You haven't found a law that mandates vaccination?
That's right. I've only found laws that will suggest that vaccination is mandatory and that will empower governments through very broad statements to implement public health programs, including vaccinations, and they'll use words like distribute. And so I don't know if that means mandatory vaccination. My interpretation is that it doesn't, because included in that law will also be a provision that says that in the event someone refuses vaccination, they will be subject to the quarantine and isolation requirements of the law. And then when I read those quarantine and isolation requirements, what I find is that, you can refuse the vaccination, but the wrinkle there, and this is sort of the loophole I found, is that if it were a child and they lost their parent's objection, then they would get mandatory. There would be, by default, mandatory vaccination. So you kind of have to get there through a long.
That's how you started off the show with that example.
That's right.
Right. Okay. So you're kind of winding us around to understand how that applies.
I'm still stuck on this one, Greg, because of course I deal with this, all the time in my practice, and I've seen laws all over the country. Are you referring to, when you say they don't mandate, you mean don't mandate absolutely because there's a way, one or more ways that people can avoid them? Is this a words here, or is there some, cause it sounds like semantics, and it sounds, and this is something I criticize non-lawyers all the time on, where people say, hey, there aren't any mandates because you have exemptions. And the problem with that semantical interpretation of the law is that it misleads people into thinking, oh, I don't have to get the vaccines, when in fact the starting place is there is a mandate unless you exercise some sort of exemption. So I'm still not quite sure I understand your point, but I suspect it may be a really important one, so I want to make sure I do understand your point. Are we talking semantics, or are you talking mandatory in an absolute sense, or is there some other point I'm missing here?
I mean, yeah, I wouldn't say it's semantics. I could point to Supreme Court case of Shuttlesworth to say that a licensing law, which purports to be a restraint on freedom of speech, is as inoperable as though it was never passed, and that the person is free to ignore it with impunity. And so that's why you don't need to go out and do an exemption affirmatively. But now allow me to caveat that big time, because I'll tell you, people don't go and rely on Shuttlesworth in real life. Yeah, I mean, we're dealing with a very fascist New World Order. When you have a public health official, and they are charged with this duty, don't expect them to know the holding of the Shuttlesworth case. Okay, they will stick that needle in your arm if you are in a particular situation, and that is their mandate. And so that's what I'm saying.
Well, let's clarify something there, because even if they did know that case, it would not be determinative of the outcome of that situation. And I think what you're talking about here is a legal argument and not a legal reality. It would take a court ruling on whether or not that case is applicable to a vaccine requirement before we would know in any definitive sense whether that's the law. And in absent that, it's an interesting legal argument, but on a practical level, it's like to use a quick analogy. I wrote this what I thought was a pretty good explanation of why a bill in Washington State that would restrict access to religious exemptions would do it in a way that violates the Constitution. And when activists there took this to the governor's office, trying to convince the governor not to sign this bill into law, the governor's office said, well, that's not our concern about whether it's constitutional or not. That's the, that's for the courts to decide. And while, in my opinion, it was a cop-out so that they, the governor could sign a law that she knew was probably unconstitutional, the strict legal reality is that until a court decides whether or not my argument is right, it is nothing more than an argument. In other words, it's not a reason that nobody has to follow that law now that it has been signed into law. A potential argument upon which one could challenge the law in court, and then if they won, the law might be stricken or affected in some way.
Well, I think that's a practical way to look at it, but I will challenge that by just stating a sentence from Shuttlesworth, and then I will pose a question to you, and I think it'll illustrate why that, although practical, is wrong. Okay, so here's the quote from the Supreme Court, Shuttlesworth. If the state converts a right into a privilege, the citizen can ignore the license and fee and engage in the right with impunity. And so that's the idea, is that the law that's being passed, it's as if it's no law. It confers, it's the same quote that I said before. It creates no office. It creates no obligation. It's as if it had never been passed. It's just a fiction. And now here's my question. And I gave also the example of the Nazi authorities. All sorts of lofty opinions. Those weren't law. Law requires virtue to be law. And that's where we as humans transcend our laws. Now, I understand that practically, you'll be very hard-pressed to find a public official who says, oh, wow, thank you for opening my eyes. Now I won't stick this needle in you. I get that. But now I'll ask my question to emphasize why that logic is flawed. So Alan, if that were the case, then is it true that if we took a time machine back to the year 1820 that African Americans are property. Is that a true or false statement?
Well, I think the obvious answer would be they were considered property under the law at that point in time, but I'm still not quite, you know, following where you're going here. So lead me on through this, please.
Are African American in the year 1820 property, or are they humans?
Potentially property. Certainly in the South at that time.
They were never property. I think they were incapable of being property, and that the law is bigger than these. It's bigger than any person.
I think I understand your point. I'm going to respectfully disagree, though, because, and this is the reason, I can go back to the same example I gave before, that the reason that I think the governor's office, even in Washington State, even if disingenuous, was still legally correct in what they did, much as I find it objectionable, because for every person who says, well, I think this is unconstitutional, or I think this violates the right to be peacefully natural, or whatever, you know, someone may say, there'll be someone on who will take the other side and say, well, I disagree, and here's why. Now, you know, sometimes I can tell you, especially as one who has practiced family law, you can see cases come to court that should never have come to court in the first place. It's somebody who's not quite altogether one way or another mentally, let's say, and they push an issue and it ends up in court and it's a black and white issue in front of the court. It's a waste of time. But there certainly are those issues where there are legitimate opposing views and interpretations and so forth. And that's why I think, again, much as I dislike it, that at least in a legal technical sense, the governor's office was right, because there are going to be people who say, well, this law isn't worded exactly the same way as the laws in these other cases and other states where they were held to be unconstitutional, and therefore, you know, we can sign this one into law legitimately, and if somebody does think it's unconstitutional, they can challenge it. I certainly agree with you in an idealistic sense that the law is, or certainly should be, such that nobody could ever legitimately, no human being could ever legitimately be deemed property. But as to whether or not somebody was or could be in any given point in time in a society, I think, you know, would maybe be a question of frame of reference. Clearly, as a practical matter, practical reality, people were treated as property, and as horrific and as that is, and shameful part of our past and history as it is, where does it, because what you're saying, here's what bothers me about what you're saying. It suggests that people can take the law into their own hands at any time and decide that something violates their inherent right and they don't have to do it. And who gets to decide that? And
I'm literally, and
when?
And they are the ones saying it. I mean, I'm directly quoting these cases. I quoted Jacobson.
Right, but as that would apply hypothetically to another situation, you know, vaccines, when that case was not about vaccines, for example, is it, you know, if people, the risk is that people listening are going to hear this and say, oh, well, as long as I think it infringes on my right to be peacefully natural, I can ignore the law. And then the question becomes, you know, are we as individuals empowered to make that decision for ourselves at any time? And I think it would be very dangerous if we were to interpret this idea in that way.
I think it is dangerous. And I think that's part of the risk of being a human in the New World Order. And no one ever promised that life would be all checkered tablecloth and lemonade, you know.
Greg, you know, one of the things that I like about our show, the BTR Homeopathy World Community, is that we give tangible, applicable things that people can do. And what I'm hearing, well, my mind has been turning about a couple of different items. And one is that it seems as if in the scenarios that you give, there must be signs and signals ahead of time that something is going to occur. It's not something that happens suddenly on a day. You know, all of a sudden somebody's going to start opening, knocking on your door, but that there is a change in society, a scare, a proclamation of pandemic or whatever it is, in order for somebody to get ready and prepared for a situation. And I feel like people need to know what they can do to be prepared. I'm kind of turning it into a little bit different direction than simply nitpicking this one little thing that we're doing. Am I right? Or I mean,
yeah, and I think I could provide a pretty decent answer to that question. Okay, so essentially what you have to do to be prepared is you have to do what the state would do for you if you were unprepared.
Okay.
So in the event that you are in a situation where the state has declared a public health emergency, and this would come from your governor, as well as possibly the president of the United States, and the public health authorities in your area are implementing a public health program. This could include vaccines. And they begin testing people. Then you have the right to resist the test and the vaccine. And to do so, you have to state a philosophical exemption or a religious exemption. So first thing you can do to prepare is know that you have that right to present this exemption. And then if they say that, you know, you must be, you know, then quarantined, then the second thing you can do is make sure that you are in a place, so when you're exercising your exemption, that you are in a place where you're already quarantined. You've already quarantined yourself. But what that means is that, I'm just going to take this right from the Emergency Health Powers Act, the Model Act, that you are providing adequate food, clothing, shelter, and medication and competent medical care. And so, you know, it's got to be a place where you are, and it has to be safe and hygienic. And so, you know, it's your typical, like, I guess, really off the grid place, you know, where you're quarantined. I mean, that's sort of the harsh reality. It's that if you're living in a very populated area and there is an infectious disease, it's going to be hard to prove that you are, you know, quarantining or isolating yourself. They're more likely to deliver you into a facility. And then in the event that you are delivered into a facility, then you will be churned out by the system, which will give you basically a military hearing where you have, you know, a certain, you know, you get to submit your brief and say, you know, why you'd like to be released, or they hold you for an indefinite amount of time and so forth. And so I'd say that that's a, you know, sort of a practical answer to how to deal with this particular situation.
Okay, we're all coming to visit with you.
So there's one other thing that you can do, and I forgot about this, because there's in addition to having exerting your exemption on philosophical and religious grounds, there's also a procedure where the public health officials are supposed to recognize a doctor's report. So if your doctor says that you would be at adverse risk by taking a vaccine, like let's say the mercury in it or the squalene in it would give you an adverse reaction, and you have that piece of paper or you have that opinion from your doctor, that's going to help.
Mm-hmm. Well, that turns it into a medical exemption, right?
Yeah, that'd be the medical exemption. That's right.
What we see in under state laws, different abilities, depending on the specific wording of state laws, for the state to whether or not the state has to accept a doctor's medical opinion, and sometimes that depends on whether the opinion is based on something that meets a pre-existing list of criteria and so forth. But I wanted to ask a question of clarification here, if I may. We're talking about a hypothetical emergency situation where the state might, say, declare an emergency, a statewide emergency, and mandate vaccines for everybody. And I think if I understand correctly from the conversation as a whole here and the context as a whole, that we're saying that the state probably does not have a right, properly and appropriately anyway, to physically force an immunization perhaps even if it doesn't have an explicit exemption right. For example, some states have laws where if the state declares an emergency and mandates a vaccine, the exemptions for routine immunizations go out the window. But it raises an interesting question, and I guess my question is, have we been talking about this next point I'm about to say all along, or is this something different? And that is more directly the question, is there potentially a situation where a state would legitimately have the right to physically force a vaccine on someone? Because the impression I get from all of these quarantine and isolation laws is that states generally, at least by implication, are saying they can't actually strap you down and inject you against your will, but they can, there can be a consequence for you to refuse a mandatory vaccine, and that would then be the quarantine and isolation options.
Yeah, and then note very carefully that the wrinkle about a child, you know, if you separate a child from his parents and then the ward becomes
right.
The state's doctors make their decisions, they're going to put a needle in that child. We had a case
during the swine flu so-called pandemic in West Virginia where reportedly a high school student, a male high school student, was held down and injected with a swine flu vaccine over his and his mother's objection. And this brings up, I think you were, talking about this earlier this evening, where even if we have a clear set of laws and boundaries and rights from whatever source, that when people get kind of hyped up and are scared and so forth, and I tell you, as out of hand as things got with such a mild disease as the swine flu, what would happen if we really did have a serious disease? But in any case, I could easily imagine people panicking and doing the inject now and ask questions later kind of mentality, just out of the fear of people even with regard to routine immunizations will sometimes display an inordinate amount of fear over the presumed threat that the occasional unvaccinated child poses. You know, it's as if my unvaccinated child suddenly causes every other child's vaccinations to not work because my unvaccinated child is considered to pose a risk not only for himself but for everybody else in the community. And even within routine immunizations, there seems to be this kind of mild, irrational fear that pervades the community, and what happens when you get and ultimately whether real or not, as we saw the swine flu pandemic, but then you have a declared emergency and media telling us how horrible and threatening and terrible this is, and if we have a real pandemic at some point as opposed to the claim going to swine flu, I am concerned about what people will do and what rights will sort of just disappear in the fear and panic. Do you have any thoughts or comments on that, Greg?
I do, yes. Yeah, the history of our country shows that certain groups are demonized when people panic. You know, look at San Francisco at the turn of the century. Then Chinese immigrants were, purportedly had the bubonic plague, and so they just quarantined. They just threw them all into one group, or during World War II with the Japanese citizens, It's this idea of demonizing one particular group, and I think, when it would come to, people who are refusing these public health measures, it would be, a real, real easy target. For people who are afraid of just generally afraid.
So history can repeat itself. So we have about 4 minutes left. Did you want to tie up all of that, what we were discussing, and save the other topics for the next show?
Yes. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I imagine it'd be easier to do a recap than try to go over nanotechnology in 4 minutes.
Okay.
So the Supreme Court of the United States recognizes that there are rights which transcend asserted laws. And so if a law is unconstitutional on its face and it affects a fundamental right, then there's a risk that by disobeying it, you could be thrown in jail and punished. But there is also a right that you have that transcends an unlawful order. And the Supreme Court has recognized your right to refuse medical treatment. And this is a right that's been recognized in many cases, and I'd refer anyone who's particularly interested to go to the case of Cruzan. Currently, we are living in a type of fascist New World Order where cases are misinterpreted deliberately to justify the extension of tyrannical powers by the state. And this is not, and I'm not saying that this is a, you know, a conspiracy on every level, but I'm saying that I found massive evidence of a conspiracy at top levels, and that public health officials at lower levels, mid levels, are simply implementing orders, thinking that they're doing it for the good of mankind. And even at the top, you can only imagine, you know, what they're thinking about for the future utopias and what have you. But you have a right to be peacefully natural, and according to your relationship with your creator, you may have a duty to do that as well.
And it sounds like what Alan said is whatever your choice is, whatever you decide to do, you will pay a consequence in one way or another. And depending on who is ruling, like at the time when you said in the 1800s when the African Americans were treated as property, even though they, in God's world order, they were not, but in the time period, they were. So in the same way, whatever is happening in our society and history today, in 2011, is what we're going to have to contend with as results.
History did not judge the Nazis favorably, so let us remember that.
Well, but that's
let us never forget that's
looking back. So we're living in the present. So how can we have a view as if we were living in the future and look back at our insanity or things that we're doing incorrectly against this peacefully natural utopian type of a world? So how do we speak to those people who are empowered to make the laws and distribute the vaccinations and deliberately not allow the exemptions and things like that? So
we speak to them in very large numbers with a unified voice to the best of our ability, or the fewer in number, the louder if possible. But no, I mean, I think that's sort of the proverbial $64,000 question. That's the question to leave open. That's for us to explore, to find out what the answer is. And because I think there's a lot of uncharted waters here, or perhaps history can help us there as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'll turn that over to you, Greg, if you have, again, comments there. I just want to get in real quick, if I may, that I concur absolutely in my own personal research about the existence of corruption at all levels, but especially at the top. And these are very challenging times that we live in. And I really, as always, Greg, just really appreciate having you here, because I learn so much from you every time you're on, and I really look forward to continuing the series with you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Alan, why don't we also just mention to the folks who are listening about your ebook? It is on the front page of Homeopathy World Community. This is about vaccinations and your rights, about exemptions and waivers, and it covers a good deal of the law, so that you can look to your, decide whether you need professional advice or take care of it on your own. So do you want to say anything more about that?
I want to just slip in a sidestep there and ask Greg if you'd be kind enough to email me any of those case names or sites if you have them. It sounds like I would. I have a lot to learn there and want to read those and get up speed, because I wasn't familiar with the things that you talked about in the Supreme Court cases today. So I would love to follow up on that, and maybe we can even post some of those.
Yeah, I think that would be great. I see these cases as being an interesting precursor to, in my worldview, of the mark of the beast, that people will have the ability to resist it, and it may cost you your life, but if you lose your life, you may gain.
And for those people who try to call into the show, we would like to let you know that in order to do that, you have to notify us who you are and what you're calling about. You can do that on the live chat by introducing yourself and telling us about your comments and questions in order to get onto the air. And just, Greg, tell us what we're going to be talking about on September, the first week in September, on Thursday at noon.
I think we should talk about nanotechnology and the the right to the commons that we all have, the right to the air and the water, and then the adequacy of traditional rules to address nanotechnology and genetically modified organism spread and things like that. You know, like the doctrine of public nuisance, you know, and the doctrine of typical civil action to address things like that. How we're transcending into a new we're unfortunately moving into this new age of widespread danger that can't be easily addressed through traditional legal mechanisms. And so how should the legal community address these new threats?
Sounds fascinating. Okay, we're going to close the show, and I want to thank you again, Greg and Alan. Until next time, bye-bye now.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate. Light your inner candle and never die.